Welcome to the new Cyber Frontier, bringing you the latest news on the local Colorado economy and initiatives that focus on the development of cybersecurity economics. You don't have to be a computer or cybersecurity expert to get plugged in. Your host, Chris Gorog, brings it straightforward, asks the tough questions, and brings the cyber world to a level of understanding for everyone. Chris is personable and opens up with our guests on the issues we all would like to see addressed. You can find us on the web at www.newcyberfrontier.com. Now join our host as he introduces the topic for today's New Cyber Frontier.
So welcome to today's episode of New Cyber Frontier. On today, I think we have a great episode here lined up. We have Colorado State Senator Kent Lambert, who is in his ninth year on the Joint Budget Committee and the vice chairman of that committee. Kent is a former U.S. Air Force retired colonel, U.S. Air Force Academy, 1974 graduate, flew B-52s for quite a few years, and was an instructor quite a few years, worked in the Pentagon, I think 8 years. And he was a notable thing. He was the first colonel to lead the Air Force Space Command Analysis Center. Also worked in a couple embassies and did a lot of budget operational analysis. But Kent, welcome today. I'll let you explain some of this stuff. How are you doing?
Good morning, Chris. Doing great. This is a, we'd like to get around to our discussion of cybersecurity, but this has come up in our state government. I think it's a real exciting time for trying to get, more cybersecurity into our governmental entities. A couple of states have tried to start this, but we're going to be looking at it real closely here in Colorado and trying to make some progress inserting more security into the state government level.
Yeah, hopefully we'll lead the way in some of this. But first, Kent, give us your background a little bit more in detail, 2 minutes or so from, stuff I might have missed there. Tell us about how you got to where you're at, though.
Well, I guess I could divide that in a couple of different areas, Chris. I started out, as you said, in the graduate of the Air Force Academy. I was a B-52 instructor pilot for many years, about 11 years. And fortunately got cross-trained into a different program in operations research and did a lot of modeling, simulation, and analysis, very, technical engineering level all the way up to campaign level modeling for our strategic nuclear forces. Did that for about 4 years and came back to the Pentagon, and they asked me to start a division to do operational analyses of the Air Force budget, and got on some pretty exciting studies in that capacity. Actually, I was the team lead for doing the analysis of all of the ICBM forces, the force structure decisions for all the ICBM forces in the Air Force. So after that, I was also overseas. I had a degree in international affairs in addition to operations research, and got to go to some U.S. embassies in Amman, Jordan, and Stockholm, Sweden, where I was both the attaché in those areas. I was defense attaché, United States defense representative in Sweden, and worked very, very intimately with both those countries on defense cooperation and military assistance. And eventually, that was one of the assignments there was with the Defense Intelligence Agency. And in the Pentagon, I was the Deputy Defense Intelligence Officer for Europe and NATO, providing information to Secretary of Defense. So that was sort of my military career. This will be my start of my 12th year in the Colorado legislature, but most of that time, 9 years now, started my ninth year on the Joint Budget Committee, was an absolutely thrilling process to look at all of state government, every department, every agency, and try to balance our budget priorities and make things work.
Wow, and that's what kind of what we, where we want to go. We're going to take a break here, come back though, and talk about what we're doing in Colorado and how that applies to the things that we talk about in cybersecurity. We'll be right back after we hear from our sponsors.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
All right, welcome back. We're talking to Colorado State Senator Kent Lambert today about what Colorado's doing in the legislature for cybersecurity and some directions we're taking. So Kent, things we had talked about, very exciting to me, looking at some, how can Colorado lead the way in possibly some legislative and governance around cybersecurity and even using blockchain. So tell us about where you're going here at a high level, and then we'll dig into some things in a bit.
Well, we probably got to go back a couple of years because I worked with the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs when they were discussing the formation of a national cybersecurity center. And this had actually been followed on with a very high-level discussion between Governor Hickenlooper and Mayor John Suthers that recognized that Colorado Springs has probably over 90 different cybersecurity companies here. We have a huge customer base with Northern Command, Air Force Space Command, the Air Force Academy, very high-tech, cyber-related military organizations and industries here in Colorado. And I think this is, everybody recognized, this is going to be evolving into a real hub of expertise for cybersecurity, not just for Colorado, but for the whole country. So I helped UCCS with their proposals there, and actually that proposal then turned into legislation, which I was the prime sponsor of that legislation to establish the National Cybersecurity Center here in Colorado Springs. So that has gotten a lot of, a lot of oars in the water, everybody mm-hmm. trying to row in the same direction. It does take some time to actually build out a physical infrastructure for this, but the important thing is I think we're at a better position of networking between, several different sectors, the military sector, academia, state government, and industry, and bringing them together, with common causes, so we are looking at things like standardization, NIST standards, techniques like blockchain technologies, things like that really should be inserted not just in academia, but also in our military, our state and local governments, and especially in commercial industry.
Yeah. So currently you have some efforts going on for looking at some new bills here. Can you tell us about what you have going on right now that will affect us, down the road here?
Yeah, I can. They're not totally on paper yet, so I'll kind of give you the 30,000 foot view of some of these. I'm working or discussing various blockchain algorithm inserts, I guess you'd call it, into some practical use cases. Mm-hmm. And without getting in too much detail, I think the things like tracking of illegal substances in the state, illegal drugs, is one application of that. Delaware is a little bit ahead of us, maybe a year ahead of us, on trying to protect public records that are vulnerable to hacking and cyber theft. Mm-hmm. Particularly, we're very concerned about public records that have to do with the ownership of corporations, the licensing of corporations, and if hackers can get inside our databases, if they're not, I think we do have some levels of security, but I think a blockchain would be a smarter way of going to a higher level of security mm-hmm. and accountability. We know we have hundreds of thousands of attacks each day on Colorado government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of them are just, the kind of thing you see in your, phishing attacks and emails and things like that. But we know that there are a lot of bad actors out there who would love and be motivated by cyber theft to get in, change our public records, and basically steal the authority of companies, the ownership of companies, or just put your name on a list so you can go out and maybe go to a bank and open up a line of credit and start siphoning off the value of a particular company
mm-hmm.
before they even know about it.
So we're talking about using
the kinds of things that require better security.
Yeah, we're talking about using smart contracts with blockchain to basically prevent fraud and to organize basically the infrastructure and the governance of the state government. And I think that's an exceptional look. I know entire countries in other parts of the world have gone to that type of a framework where it's almost like a virtual, trying to get all their records outside of where databases could be compromised type of thing into more of a distributed ledger.
If a hacker gets into these things, and if you have a blockchain there for accountability, hopefully it will detect external attacks. But also, let's say, we have a lot of databases that move literally hundreds of millions of dollars around, whether it's the mm-hmm. Medicaid system, the food stamp programs. We know there's fraud in these programs, and if we can reorganize the data under some strict rules, and even if government employees just, let's say, they make a typing mistake or something like that doesn't add up, that rule set should help, trace down the errors and provide a new level of accountability over our government funds.
Yeah. So how much, have you done any looks into it to see how much money this could save the state for, certain programs that you've identified?
Well, we haven't really been able to cost this out. We know anecdotally, we have done several audits showing, let's say money getting out of its channels in like welfare programs. There have been extensive audits of this.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's very difficult to extrapolate that statewide. I would say if we looked at the small number of cases that have been audited and then extrapolated to that to the state, it would probably be hundreds of millions of dollars.
Wow.
That kind of just walk out the door because we don't know that the errors are there.
Yeah.
We have a new database in our Department of Healthcare Policy and Financing that is basically an entirely new payment system for Medicaid doctors and providers of various kinds. And it's had a rough startup, and part of the rough startup has been because it's asking for more accountable information from some of the providers. That may not be the only problem that database has, but it has slowed things down a little bit because the program demands to know that when we have a provider that we know their physical address, for instance. We never asked that question before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been difficult and slow to increase or to put that kind of thing in the database, but it's there to prevent fraud. And I think in some cases we have prevented fraud. It's been, unfortunately, it's slowed down the payment system, perhaps to some of the legitimate providers. But as you know, security is always inversely proportional to convenience. So, you know, we, you know, and hopefully we'll get, you know, by some of these startup costs and delays and have a more robust and more fraud-resistant system in the future.
Yeah, and that's why I was asking about the money, because that's often, or so often, the most difficult thing to to determine the return on investment for spending on cybersecurity. So if we're putting some new platforms in, we have to say, what is it that we're going to save in the future? So let's talk about that when we get back from here from our sponsors. Give us a minute here.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Over 3 million data breaches happen every single day. That's over 2,000 records being compromised every minute. So often, we focus on securing web data access. But what if the attackers are already inside, having gained direct access to your storage through data management software? When it comes to communications that go directly into your storage devices, make SNIA your first line of protection. SNIA's conformance testing limits outdated communications that are known to be used by attackers. It works continuously behind the background to make sure your storage is protected. To find out if your data is truly secure, visit our website at www.snia.org/cybertest.
All right, welcome back. We're talking to Colorado State Senator Kent Lambert about what the Colorado legislature is doing for cybersecurity. And we were talking before the break about return on investment for programs that, the government might spend to organize with blockchain some governance with some state programs. And Kent, I had asked right before the break about, you know, how much money would be saved or could be saved by implementing one of these programs. And you had thrown out a number, hundreds of millions of dollars. We know from audits that leak out of some of these systems. That seems like a pretty good driver for spending some money to get next generation systems that might alleviate a lot of that. What is the willingness of the Colorado legislature to do that?
Well, you know, the National Cybersecurity Bill, I think, went through the both houses of the legislature unanimously. There doesn't seem to be any, you know, political pushback on this. I don't know, one individual might have come out and vote against it just for some symbolic argument, but I think there's a great deal of bipartisan support for, looking at cybersecurity from the point of view of, we know we all have a problem. Mm-hmm. And, getting back to the costs of this, there are two other things to consider that are pretty major. One is cost avoidance. You know, if we do nothing, what are the downstream implications, financial implications of that? I mentioned, you know, the possibility of getting in and changing public records and then committing fraud with that information. Well, that cost may not be within the state government, but we know that there have been huge releases of personal information. That's another bill I'm working on, by the way, is protection of personal identifying information, because we don't really have enough in our statutes right now, so we're working with the Attorney General's office on that discussion. But let's say, we've seen, there's lawsuits in motion right now, the Sony Corporation, for their big release many years ago, which still hasn't finished the court, the legal process. Now we have the Experian cases. How did the hackers get into Experian? Was it inside job, or did they steal public records from the states to get inside those firewalls and do all the damage they did? We don't know. Mm-hmm. At least I don't know. But we need to have, a more robust system of defense, and then we also need to have a little bit of offense. One of the changes we made is we actually have law enforcement officers now within our Office of Information Technology. So if they see that a crime is being committed, they actually have badges and guns, and they can go and knock on doors and put people under arrest if they've broken the law. But we really have a dearth of public policy in this area. Like, how do you, if you have a hacker from Maryland who's hacking into a Colorado database, how do you actually go out and arrest them, even if you know who they are?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that suggests that we need to have not just the federal government's assistance, but need to have some interstate cooperation, MOUs or interstate compacts, to set up a law enforcement system where we can, pursue criminals. And we do, to some extent, but it needs to be expanded. Same thing applies to international attacks. I know we've had a couple of cases. I won't mention the countries, but you'd think, oh, well, this country is not really our friend, but their hackers are attacking some people in Colorado, and you find out, well, if you give them a phone call, they don't like having hackers in those countries either. Because they're hacking the country. They're sort of equal opportunity hackers, you know, so they sometimes love having that information so they can put their own people in jail if they're, attacking their own people. So,
yeah.
So
this private...
moving there. The other thing is, we haven't really talked about the Internet of Things. I know that's been a topic on your show here several times.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm starting to ask questions of our Office of Energy, Colorado Energy Office, as well as our Public Utilities Commission, just to get an idea of, what are we doing today to try to protect our infrastructure itself,
mm-hmm.
and especially networks, whether it's a liquid or a compressed natural gas pipeline, or if it's a train system, the switches on that, the smart grids that are controlling electrical power. All of these have certain vulnerabilities that we need to understand better, and then see if we can use some cyber defenses in those areas as well.
Mm-hmm. So when you're looking, well, first I want to go back and talk about the privacy. So generally, our country has taken a different stance than, say, the European Union on privacy and individuals' information, where the companies are really given the power over anything that the individuals give them, saying, we're connecting to your networks, we're using your equipment, so you really own what we give you as our information transfers. But in the EU, they've made some really strict privacy requirements. So, fines, stiff fines on companies for a release of private information. Do you see that our state could change and go differently than, say, the federal approach to privacy here? Or what's your thoughts on where that goes?
Well, I think since we're, at least I believe the state of Colorado still has some sovereignty where we can make some of our own decisions without the federal government. We need to enforce our local laws. And if a company intentionally is negligent, that's, like I mentioned, the Sony case and the Experian case, which I think they just filed a large lawsuit against Experian here this week. We need to have some penalties if you have that kind of cavalier attitude.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you one thing. We've had some cavalier events here among state employees,
mm-hmm.
where fortunately a lot of the data that they were handling, as far as I know, didn't get out of the public, but it sure could have, with social security numbers, personal identifying information. And from what I could tell, it was accidental, but that shows that we don't have adequate protections in place to make sure that, people handling privacy information are really following a strict set of rules. We probably need more ergometric type of design of identifying people who are at computer keyboards and things like that. And I think we're starting to move into that area. I think the U.S. military is way theme of security. I think that's we've gone probably too far in that area, and there are probably several examples of that. You mentioned in Europe, you know, I mean, they've been a surveillance, you know, whether it's England or East Germany, they've had public surveillance of almost everybody for decades. And now there are wonderful ideas in the United States that, gee, if we could only have a network of everybody's cell phone, and if you allow the police to access your cell phone, there'd be that many more surveillance cameras everywhere in the country. Now, is that a public policy that we really want to do? Would it increase security? Probably would. But do I really want every single cell phone that I see taking pictures of me in public for the purposes of a police investigation?
Yeah, you definitely...
You know, that gets to be very, very scary.
You definitely have that balance between, you know, what is your reasonable right to expectation of privacy versus, you know, these systems that are possible. And that, but then somebody that's... doesn't have the ethics that, say, a government would have, can go in and just, as a hacker, do it themselves. So, you know, we kind of on both sides of that, how do we utilize the technologies out there? So a question about just, do you think that for what you're doing in the legislature for privacy, is it more of a, we need a technology solution, or are we going to start looking at the human aspect of it and put some, you know, steeper requirements on the people, the companies, that they have to follow and comply with certain things?
Well, I think they do merge together. If you're going to set up a accountable system with some strict rule sets that are, you know, embedded in certain computer programs and so forth, those rule sets have to follow the law. You know, I don't necessarily want to hack into every, you know, even with government, you know, government systems, basically hack into everybody's records and then, you know, have a rule set that, that makes it available to everybody. Here's a good example. I think we're talking right now, you know, all the counties in the state with mail-in ballots look at your signatures and see, well, is, you know, and I think it's rather an unsecure way of doing it in the first place, but let's say you have a pretty high confidence by looking at somebody's signature on the record of whether or not that signature on the ballot, back of the ballot envelope, is really valid. And that's what's being used today. Unfortunately, each county generally follows a different standard. Some use computer scanners, and they use you know, computer-assisted screening to see if the the ballots are valid. Others, if you remember the Florida election, you know, where they were looking at hanging chads by holding them up to the light. I mean, others are using basically that kind of level of technology and untrained people to you know, look at signatures and say, well, that looks about right. And it becomes very subjective. Now, I think one of the proposals is let's organize and protect all of these signatures, because right now, if you're a voter in Colorado and you've provided a sample on your you know, on your registration, voter registration, the state probably has your signature. Now, isn't it important to protect, you know, 6.5 million, whatever the state population is, protect those signatures from hackers or from anybody else who wants to use them, maybe not for voting purposes, but maybe I could sign a check with those signatures on a massive scale.
Yeah.
And who would ever be the wiser? Because I know I can take a computer and use desktop printing to, you know, write off what looks like somebody's check. And now if I have what looks like his valid signature, I can whip that on there electronically, and you know, now I've committed check fraud, you know?
Yeah.
So
We have that in corporate.
I'm concerned about that kind of information getting anywhere near a public release.
Yeah, and I see where you're going with the corporate documents, because right now we're using in business all the time where signatures are emailed, documents are emailed back and forth with signatures from two people to form a contract for business operations. So, and those are digitally now stored in databases with the state and probably other companies that we work with where, wow, one person hacked into it. They got a repository of millions of signatures. That's a interesting thought to pursue, I guess I would say.
Well, also we have, we've had it's a little bit ponderous, but we have a system of notary publics around the state mm-hmm. who get training from, formal training from our Secretary of State's office. But generally, if you go down to the bank or you are go to a private notary someplace, they will use their little seal on that document that you want to have notarized, and they'll put it in their little ledger book, mm-hmm. okay, a paper copy that they keep. Well, how do I go back and trace into that? Let's say somebody has just their own notary business in their office or their home. What if there's a fire and those records are destroyed?
Mm-hmm.
Now, do all the notarizations go away? I'm not exactly sure how the system, records all that, but I think it's very reliant upon a paper system. Now, let's say I'll buy another thing. We are looking at, remote. Secretary of State's office has talked about remote notarization. Well, wouldn't that be interesting if we could take a document, somewhere in Colorado Springs, and we want to have it notarized with a party up in Denver? Maybe we could put that on an authorized blockchain and actually scan the document in or something like that, but then put in a hash saying this is really an authorized notarization of this document.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting.
And,
so we talked about, though, the blockchain. We talked about privacy, IoT. It seems like, and everything kind of comes together. With blockchain, we have the ability, we've seen with the cryptocurrencies, to have a distributed trust, but at the same time, individual privacy protection. Do we strive for, in our IoT, an individualized privacy model that uses blockchain but has that individualized privacy aspect as well? It seems like there's kind of the marriage of both worlds that work great here if we can get the technology to match the regulatory solution. What are your thoughts?
Well, exactly. And it's not just the lawyers and it's not just the technologists that are involved with this. It has to be both. It really has to be both. So, and that makes the, it's a new branch of law, I think, when we're talking about technologies that didn't exist, even a couple of years ago. So,
mm-hmm.
We have to adapt and we have to make our legal system follow the classical ideas of individual privacy, individual civil rights, at the same time be able to either exploit or avoid, the engineering technologies that are creating new problems. So,
yeah, how far out do you see a solution being, or the first part of this that we're looking at hitting the ground? How many years out do you see actual implementation being?
Well, as far as a bill on expanding individual, privacy of personally identifying information, we're working on that right now. I think that bill will be started in the House. I will probably be the prime sponsor in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
But that's exactly the type of thing we're looking at right now with the Attorney General's office. It's important to look back and say, well, we know this is a problem, but we do want the legal experts who are now involved in reviewing cases, where individual identifying information has already been a problem, mm-hmm. go back, look at the case law and say, well, how can we fix this? And is this just case law that's decided by a judge when somebody has already committed a crime? Or do we need to go back and put this in statute and apply it, more proactively to, certain areas of law? So.
Okay. But you have your bird's getting kind of frisky there.
Yeah, sorry about that. My home studio here, I have a cockatiel that's very upset.
Yeah, that's all right. We like to hear some pets there and occasionally. But as far as...
I think your show probably needs a mascot, so I'll be glad to give you the cockatiel here, and you can use it for a mascot to start the program.
Yeah, I could have it on every show then, right?
Every show, yeah.
I mean, as far as putting legislative stuff in the order, I've seen for years that we regulate cybersecurity, we regulate requirements for privacy, and it just makes more paperwork, more compliance requirements for companies, and they spend all their budget on cybersecurity just trying to comply with the basic minimum, I just wonder when does a solution come in where we start to pull something together that makes a technology solution that works with the legislation that we're putting through?
Well, I think in many cases, the technology, since, transactions are often repeatable, if the technology is in there to protect the data, it's a lot more robust than looking at subjective human decisions.
Yeah.
As your sole basis of determining what's privacy and what's not. Here's a good example. HIPAA, for protecting medical privacy.
Mm-hmm.
We've discussed this a little bit, and in one case there was an accusation that a state employee had intentionally released HIPAA data, but to prove that it was so circuitous and so subjective that it just was not provable that the employee had done anything intentionally wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd actually talked to congressional staffers about that, and I said, well, what are the rules for protecting HIPAA data?
Mm-hmm.
And if you have, maybe there needs to be some cases where certain elements of personal privacy, maybe in a high-profile case or something, need to be released to the courts or to Congress or somebody like that for examination. How do you do that? Well, I found there are very, very subjective rules about HIPAA.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the HIPAA rules are what other people or hospitals or doctors or state legislators have read into the system, but it's not actually part of HIPAA.
Mm-hmm.
HIPAA is very, very vague on how to do this. But yet, look at the probably at this point billions of dollars that we use to drive hospital administration of HIPAA.
Mm-hmm.
It's just gigantic. I one time talked to the CEO of Memorial Hospital, and I said, how much of a medical bill goes into the actual cost of doing a procedure versus the administrative overhead?
Mm-hmm.
And he said what I've read in other articles, like in Wall Street Journal, that say about 60 to 65% of our medical costs in the United States go to administration.
Mm-hmm.
That's not trivial. And when administration is driven by an attempt at privacy, I think, it's a laudable goal, but it would probably be a lot cheaper and a lot more private if we directed our attentions to how to secure the data that we have and only release it to the authorized people, again, strict rule sets.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, trying to allow every doctor and nurse and physical therapist in the system to guess as to what's the right you know, rules under certain circumstances. So, you know, I think there could be better structure, better stewardship of private, personally identifying information. At the same time, you know, cutting down this hugely expensive administrative burden.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you're on the right track, though, to look at blockchain and technologies and smart contracts as a future in maintaining that, you know, public record, but privacy components. So if we took a step back, we're getting kind of to the point where we're kind of people stop listening if I get too much longer on shows. But is there anything that you need or that you would like to get out to the public about things that they can help with, be involved with, or things that you need help with?
Well, you know, we're looking at, for instance, the National Cybersecurity Bill. When I wrote that, it actually, I inserted the importance of education, public education, on a lot of these issues. How do we change our curriculum, even for, you know, high school down to elementary school kids? They're learning about computers, but are they really learning about, you know, the public policy that goes along with the stewardship of information? Or are we passively, as a society, just waiting for something bad to happen? Have a cyber 9/11 where things are, you know, the first thing we see is a catastrophic result. Now, some of our, I mean, let's just face it, Chris, you know, those of us that are talking on the show here or are listening to the show are probably already geeks. And probably some percentage of your viewership here or listenership watch Mr. Robot on television. Well, their latest episode, spoiler alert here, showed the type of catastrophic events that could happen, you know, and it's all fictional. Well, it's not all fictional because a lot of it's based on what could actually happen. But their latest episode showed really a national-level disaster caused by cyber hacking. We are not thinking about that as a society. And, you know, I've gone back to Homeland Security since about 1985 when nobody was paying any attention to it. And we didn't until we had 9/11. And we're still picking up the pieces because, you know, now actually we do have another state program that I'm trying to work with called FirstNet, and it's actually a national program to improve the communications and data systems of all of our first responders. Very, very laudable goal. But again, it's just starting. And we need to make sure that, cybersecurity, things like that, are well represented into that. So I just encourage people to get more involved with formal education and then just individual education, especially from our corporations. If they get hit and just really don't know what's going to happen to them, they shouldn't be taking a passive stance on that. They should get out and learn what those threats are. And sometimes it's difficult because of a lot of our players in government are at the federal government level and not so much at the state and local level. And I think that's one trend we need to improve.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining today. It's definitely been interesting to hear from the perspective of what we're looking at on the future path for legislation in cybersecurity. And I would love to hear listeners out there from other states come on and talk about what we're doing in different states around the country in the kind of the same or similar efforts. But thanks a lot for listening today, and thanks for joining today, Kent. It was great to hear your thoughts on this.
Well, on the other hand, Chris, you know, we're trying to make Colorado a real leader in this field, and we've talked, you know, the more we do and the quicker we do it in Colorado, the quicker Colorado becomes sort of a center of gravity of all this, and the commercial opportunities, the government opportunities are we're just beginning to peel back the onion on that. I think it's going to be just magnificent opportunities for people in the future here to get into this field.
Yeah, for everybody and be a leader in it, and you know, for the rest of the world. But thanks a lot today, Kent. Thanks for being on.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
All right. Have a good one. Bye. The views or opinions expressed by me during this podcast are my own and are not those of my employer, Colorado Technical University.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of New Cyber Frontier. Remember to get involved. Often we think that someone else will handle privacy and security in the virtual world, but you are the only one truly in command of your virtual fate. Join our mailing list so we can keep you informed of breaking news and new releases. If you have an idea, if you have a question that you would like to hear answered, or if you want to get involved with our efforts, reach out to us at newcyberfrontier.com. We also encourage you to visit our sponsors' links, as they are the ones that really make this show possible. I want to thank each of you for supporting the show, and we look forward to seeing you back for the next episode of New Cyber Frontier.